It's time to scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today we're going to be visiting with Kevin Koch, author of The Driftless Land, and talk to him about that and creative writing. Then we'll hear from Garrison Keillor and The Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Kevin, welcome back to WVIK. You were here last month on Saturday Morning Live talking about The Driftless Land, and obviously we haven't exhausted that subject. I think before we do anything else, though, maybe you could tell us exactly what The Driftless Land is. That is not a term I was familiar with until I was handed your book.
Oh, okay, sure. Well, thanks for again for having me back again. The Driftless Land or Driftless Area or region is about a 20,000 square mile region of northeast Iowa, southeast Minnesota, northwest Illinois, and southwest and big chunk of central Wisconsin that was bypassed by all the glaciers, or at least on its edges only touched by the oldest of the old glaciers. And as a result, it has a much more rugged topography than much of the Midwest. It has a lot of river bluffs and deep ravines and rock towers and things like that, whereas where the glaciers passed by, they kind of did a bulldozing effect on the landscape.
Yeah, the weight of those glaciers was just phenomenal. You mentioned earlier that the ice could be 2 to 5 miles deep.
Yeah, amazing.
And I guess the land is still kind of coming back from all that, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It actually, if you think of the tectonic plates as floating in a sense, they actually push the landscape down and where they sat on. And so in the 12,000 years since they melted, the landscape is still rising back from their weight.
Well, it was that last glacier, was it the Wisconsin, that created the Rock Island Rapids, pushed the river across a section that it, so that we're the new kids on the block here on Rock Island.
Yeah, well, I guess we share that. We're not in the Driftless Land, but we caught the aftermath of that.
That's right, yeah.
It passed you by and got us. But what prompted you to write about the Driftless Land?
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up in Dubuque. Attended college at Loras as an undergraduate, and had a couple of stints for graduate school down the road in Iowa City, and have done some travels elsewhere. But most of my life has been in the Dubuque area, and I grew up loving the outdoors. I had some neighbors who would take me camping, but I think it wasn't really until until I'd been teaching for a while and had been outside the region more often, that it really began to strike me that this was a unique landscape amid the rest of the Midwest.
Would you go so far as to say driftless is more than an adjective describing geology, but that in some sense driftless refers to the solid people who live here?
Yeah, I think, in fact, in the last 10, 15 years, I think that term driftless has really kind of caught on, and people are identifying the region. And I think it's because there's just this really interesting combination going on of, there's farmers and artists and factory workers and writers and entrepreneurs who 15, 20 years ago might have looked at each other a little suspiciously, but in the meantime have come to enjoy each other's quirks and realize we're all in this landscape together. And then there's something unique about the landscape on top of that you get these mysterious rock towers rising out of nowhere, and you'll get this mist coming off of the river and oh, there's this place near my home. What you get sometimes in the Driftless, it'll be these caves with a vertical shaft opening. And so in the wintertime, you'll get warm air coming up. And one time I was off in the woods, and I took a handful of powdery snow and threw it across the top, and it puffed it up in the air. And I wrote about it, talking about one of the places where the earth breathes. So there's this uniqueness of the landscape that I think combines with the uniqueness.
Well,
people.
I had never thought about that till you just mentioned it. But I'm to me, examples would be Decorah, Iowa,
yeah,
with its mix of farmers and Postville.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Upper Iowa University,
yeah,
and I'm assuming Dubuque, too.
Mm-hmm.
That leads me to a question that I would really like to ask of you personally, but also of the land. There's a famous essay, and I cannot remember the author's name, on the sacred and the profane, in which he describes two kinds of people: the profane person who settles where he settles because that's where his job is, or because he can afford the house, or for whatever secular reason. And then there are those sacred people that we call, depending on where they live or where their soul calls them, river rats, desert rats, mountain men, and so forth. Do you think they're? Do you think what you've just described is a driftless rat?
Absolutely. Again, you know, I think it goes back to that unique combination of people that I talked about, and just these. I mean, if the people have quirks, so does the landscape, and you just find these unique little.
Well, do you think there's a kind of cause effect there?
Yeah, I do. I always think that the landscape has an impact on the people, and
could it be that you're merely comfortable where you are, that you are in a place and it suddenly seems that place expresses you or contains you in a way that you just feel right at home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's a little bit of both. There's a wonderful essay by Bill Holm called the name escapes me at the moment, but the essay is about the prairie eye and the woods eye. And he talks about the prairie eye as being the eye of clarity, of being able to see for distances. And his preference is, he's the prairie eye. But he talks about the woods eye, and that's the eye that in the woods, the woods is a place that's a little bit more mysterious, and you're not sure what's behind that set of trees or in that gully. And so I think that's a way in which the landscape can kind of create the personality of the person.
Could you read a little bit of The Driftless Land?
Sure. I'll start with the very beginning of the book, and it's about a page worth.
Okay.
Driftless. My thoughts are poised this day on an overlook of the Mississippi, 400 feet above the mile-wide expanse of river, taking in the view of the forested bluffs hugging the shorelines and a small town basking in the floodplain. Just as quickly, I am inland, in a deep ravine of tumbled limestone boulders and a fragile, broken shale, where a small stream erupts from a spring and the damp chill guards against the summer's oppressive heat. I am on a rounded hill in winter, at the edge of woods, cross-country skiing as the daylight fades, my body warm against the icy wind. I am pedaling up a steep incline at the mines of Spain, luxuriating in the fullness of summer sweat. I am hiking with my wife on a trail that climbs and drops and climbs again, from stream bottom to river bluff, through woods and fingerling prairies. I've stumbled onto a Native American burial mound hidden in the woods, silent, forgotten, unnoticeable except for a slight swell against the lay of the land. My thoughts put me anywhere, everywhere, in the places that I know in the Driftless Land. It's what I've sometimes imagined the afterlife to be, a movement of soul, like the wind across the landscape, driftless.
It's an interesting set of essays. As I go through the book, there are little passages, some short, some long, mm-hmm, some historic, some personal.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting, almost scattershot, as the way your mind might move from topic to topic.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of another question. You teach creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really think you can teach students to write like that? I mean, in other words, can creative writing be taught? Coleridge called imagination the repetition in the finite mind of the eternal act of creation. Mm-hmm. What can you do in your classroom?
I think it's a lot like coaching. I mean, in athletics, sure, an athlete has to have a certain amount of innate athletic ability, but a good coach can really bring that out. And I think that's what creative writing teachers do, is to find where the spark is. And,
so you're steering more than teaching?
Well, steering is teaching, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, but you can also, I mean, there's certain techniques that you'll teach as well. But for the most part, yeah, you know, they'll put something out on the table and coach it along.
Okay.
You lit up on one phrase he used, creative, what was it, creative?
Creative nonfiction, which presses a bell of mine because when I started teaching, I taught, you know, writing. and all it was supposed to be creative, right? And then in comes this invented phrase, creative nonfiction, as opposed to what, dull fiction or dull nonfiction?
That's right.
Why did that phrase become so popular that it is now a course?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, it's not a term that I particularly like. I think it sounds like an oxymoron, or the path that a lot of political campaigns go these days, you know, but or maybe that's more fiction. But creative nonfiction is I like to think of it as tinted window versus a clear window. Clear window is when it's that kind of prose that you really don't want your audience to even notice the window, the language. So good journalism, you're paying attention to only basically should be to the message and not the messenger or the language per se. Directions on how to put a bicycle together, you know. Let's just look at the subject. And I love to do that kind of writing. But I think what creative nonfiction is more of a tinted window, where not only is the subject matter of importance, but you also want the reader to engage in the language more so than when they're reading how to put their bicycle
together.
And
the writer, too, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So you've engaged in creative nonfiction in The Driftless Land.
I hope so.
I would say it's good nonfiction.
Accused.
Do you have any projects coming up?
I do. So I've been, you know, obviously writing about The Driftless Land for quite a few years, but I also then a couple of years back taught in Ireland for a semester, and then returned there this spring with some time off and some funding. And so I lived in the west of Ireland for 2 months, and I'm currently working on a project that links place in Ireland to place in the Driftless with a connecting theme of Celtic spirituality of nature. And I'm still working through a first draft, and it's just a project at this stage, but my working title is The Thin Places, Spiritual Landscape from Ireland to the Driftless.
That's that'll be quite a connection. I mean, I don't know how you would do that.
Some days I don't either.
Is it similar structure, similar people, a similar feeling you get, or what?
Yeah, it's not necessarily similarity of the landscape, because they are quite different. It's more that something in one landscape evokes a similar kind of feeling, for me at least, in the other landscape. And I'll give you a quick example. In this example, the principle is the holy may be found in the remote and the austere places. Okay, so in that sense, I'm looking at the Aran Islands, where the early Celtic Christian monks went to, you know, just live by themselves for a while before they would form a monastery. And it's just this bleak, rocky landscape. It's wonderful. So I connect that up. We were talking earlier about the other program about Trempealeau. Now, Trempealeau, Wisconsin, which is about 15, 20 miles northeast of north of La Crosse, Wisconsin, on the one hand, it's neither austere nor remote. It's a beautiful landscape, beautiful.
What is it precisely?
It is. Trempealeau is a small town on the Mississippi River. There's a mountain in the river that is kind of a bluff that was cut off from the landscape. But at Trempealeau, there were some mounds created by a civilization from Cahokia back in about around 1100. That's 500 miles downriver. And so for people of that civilization, they brought up their own pottery, they brought up their own tools because they didn't know if they were going to find the things they needed when they went there. And settled this outpost 500 miles away. And while it may be a lush and luxurious in the summer, in the wintertime, in the year 1100, that must have been an austere place. But in these mounds, they're spiritual mounds. They were ceremonial mounds. So you just sort of have this sense of discovering the holy in these remote, austere places, whether it be Trempealeau, whether it be the Aran Islands. So that's kind of the way in which I'm making a connecting link.
Do you think your connection with New Mallory influenced you on that?
Very much. I mean, I don't have a drop of Irish blood, although that's that comes from my wife's side. But there's something about that landscape that connects me. But in the Dubuque area, Dubuque is very much an Irish as well as German ethnic area. And the monks of New Mallory came directly from Mount Mallory in Ireland. They were invited by Bishop Loras in the 1840s to settle in what's now Western Dubuque County. And so the monks came, right from Ireland in the thick of the famine, established a monastery here.
So you've got a framework for this new book?
Yeah. Focusing it around eight Celtic feasts and or celestial events. So you get the two equinoxes, the two solstices, and then equal distant from each of those, there's a Celtic feast like Bealtaine and Lunasa and Samhain and Imolc. So that's kind of my framework.
This sounds interesting. Do you have a name for it yet?
Yeah, or at least a working name called the Thin Places, Spiritual Landscape from Ireland to the Driftless.
Kevin Koch is at it again. Thank you very much for being with us today, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
The Driftless Land can still be located, and the forthcoming book, well, we'll tell you about it as soon as it's here. Right now, we're going to tell you about Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Time now to dive into the book bag, and I see he has his hand in there already.
Well, I think before I talk about what I want to talk about today, we ought to mention that Kevin Koch's book, The Driftless Land, is available at Amazon.com as well as its publisher, Southeast Missouri State University Press, but Amazon would be the place to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought when we're recording this will be a few weeks later than that, but the new Hancher Auditorium has just been rededicated and opened at a cost of, $150 million or something like that. I thought it might be time to go back and look at the dedication of the first Hancher Auditorium, which occurs in one of those great university expose novels, which are a genre unto themselves. This one is by Vance Borghele, who taught for a year or two at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa. And when he left, he repaid Iowa with a novel called Now Playing at Canterbury. And it dealt with the gathering for the opening of Hancher of directors and actors and singers from all over the United States to come and put on a performance of a new opera commissioned just for Hanscher called 7.5 Cents. And it every weird professorial type, there are no other kinds, get skewered here. And Iowa was not very happy with now playing it. Roy Carver is here, the philanthropist who loved to go to Iowa, you know, the Carver Center over there. But now playing at Canterbury is really a great read. The Quad Cities is in there with a little hanky-panky going on with the University of Iowa. If you graduated from Iowa especially, go back if you haven't read it and look at Now Playing at Canterbury.
It just moved to the top of my most wanted list.
It is. There is also one about the University of Illinois by Herbert Cubley, who spent a year as a visiting professor there and then wrote The Whistling Zone, which skewers Illinois up one side and down the other. It is really funny. There's a 2-foot-high midget who is an evangelist. But if you've been to the University of Illinois, you will recognize all the places and you will recognize many of the professorial types. You know, the universities are strange places because in the 1950s, when the man in the gray flannel suit came out complaining about how all the cubicles in offices are all alike and everybody there dresses alike, university is not a place for men in the gray flannel suit.
Oh, no.
At all. A lot of these are good, clean fun. These aren't really nasty, but you probably don't want to be the provost of a college. Bernard Malamud, the Jewish American writer, probably the best of all of these writers, spent a stint at Oregon State, and he repaid them with a little novel called A New Life. In England, Kingsley Amis wrote Lucky Jim. Mary McCarthy, whom some of you recommend, she was a writer in very popular 30 years ago, called The Groves of Academe. Richard Russo, another contemporary writer, wrote Straight Man, about a one-book author who is stuck at West Central Pennsylvania State University, and he can't get any place because he has no more creative juices left. And The Light and the Dark by C.P. Snow, the writer about science and literature, is about a young Cambridge linguist trying to have faith in spite of all the evidence. At any rate, there are a whole series of really interesting university books.
Never let an author onto your campus. Is that what you're telling us?
No, I'm saying, I'm encouraging somebody out there who feels like writing, who graduated from Ambrose or Augustana, to get busy. And, you know, we have our types in the Quad Cities, too.
Actually, I wrote a very lame musical called An Ambrosian Tragedy, I think it was.
Right. No, these university novels are worth reading.
Now opening at Canterbury.
Playing at Canterbury is Vance Borgeli's the one that reminded the Hanscher Auditorium reopening reminded me of.
Well, okay, as I say, that'll move right to the
I forgot
top.
One.
Yeah.
Jane Smiley's Moo You, which is a little expose of Iowa State University at Ames.
Oh, they get in their licks, don't they?
they do get even.
We got our licks in today, but we'll be back next week for more. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Join us again next Saturday for the next session of Scribble.